Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the light. My guest today is Marshall Clarfeld, who has what he claims is a groundbreaking new book, Adam, the Missing Link. And he says that this blows the lid off a closely held package of historical and scientific facts proving that the human race was created by genetic engineering technology nearly a quarter of a million years ago. So, this will undoubtedly be a very interesting program. Welcome to it, Marshall.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Well, I'm sure it's going to prove extremely interesting. Can I just start you off by making a point here that
sure.
There appears at different times to have been archaeological claims that human remains have been found going back further than a quarter of a million years. Now, how would you answer that in light of your own claim that the genetic engineering technology took place about that time ago?
Well, I think the differentiation, according to the evolutionary theory, one species over a long period of time evolves into another species.
Right.
And the most prominent species at the time we're talking about was called Homo erectus. And Homo erectus was really kind of a creature that had a third the brain size of Homo sapiens, and it had evolved for 1,800,000 years, and its advanced tool-making were stones and spears. Now, 250,000 years ago appears our species, Homo sapiens. And there's supposed to be an archaeological bone record between these two species to show the evolution.
Right.
So far, nobody's found it.
In other words,
we just kind of appear. And I was curious as to how that happened. And my book is kind of a window into mankind's history that goes back 250,000 years.
Right.
Based on several things.
Yes. Now, I have of my own accord, prior to this, read some of Sacharai Sitchin's books about Sumeria, and undoubtedly there is sufficient evidence in the tablets there to show that the Anunnaki were very active with that particular group of people, and you do refer to them. Now, do you feel that they are the only people involved in our genetic engineering? Because why I ask that question is, where there have been contact with space beings, they talk of our evolution starting with people from the constellation of Lyra, and then at different times having been modified by the Pleiadians and so forth. Now, I know the Anunnaki period is possibly the most recent one, but do you give any weight to that information as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think planet Earth is kind of like a 7-Eleven. Everybody stops in and does something.
Right.
And there is ample evidence, and I'm sure you're aware of it, Mike, that the Anunnaki were not the only influence on Homo sapiens. But for the record, I was trying to find solid evidence that I could support the theory of genetic engineering, which they claim in the tablets is what they did. And so what I did in the book, and it's quite illustrative because I put about 145 color pictures in it to show the evidence, of other things that are here on this planet that the Anunnaki claim title to.
Yes.
And if you take it and kind of draw a circle and connect the dots, you get a pretty overwhelming evidentiary picture that the things that were written, the texts that were written in the cuneiform tablets, are supported by physical evidence of other archaeological sites.
Right. Now, the question there, therefore, is can you give us some information, some very important finds of that nature that support your claims?
Yes, yes. Besides the cuneiform tablets, the Anunnaki created what are called cylinder seals, Mike. And for your audience that's unfamiliar with it, the British Museum happens to have a ton of them, along with the cuneiform tablets. And these cylinder seals were made out of hematite, which is a very, very hard stone. In fact, if you were to compare its hardness, you could say it's like steel. And a cylinder seal is maybe an inch tall and a half inch in diameter, and it's polished, and it's engraved in negative drawings around the surface, so that when you take it like a rolling pin and roll it over wet clay, you get a positive picture. I would suggest that the audience, if they want to look up the most famous of these seals, they go to Google and touch in V like in Victor, A like in Abel, 243.
Well, I think you better repeat that one, because people might like to write that down right now.
Okay, sure. V like in Victor, A like in Abel, 243. It's a Sumerian cylinder seal, and it shows some very interesting photographs. Actually, well, it's not a photograph, but it's a way device. I call it a stored information device, which has lasted thousands and thousands of years, which shows a picture of the Anunnaki and what they were doing. But this particular seal, which I find very significant, they threw in gratis in the upper left-hand corner, which the people will see when they pull it up, a complete depiction to scale of our solar system.
Right.
The seal's probably 4,600 years old, but, you know, who knew that there were more than five planets at that time?
Right.
And it also shows Nibiru, the planet that they came from. So that's one piece of evidence that I find in conjunction with the cuneiform tablets. These seals show pictures of what they look like and what they were doing, which kind of verifies the story. Now, in addition to that, I've in the book detailed 14 major pieces of evidence. For instance, the pyramids, the Stonehenge, the stones at Baalbek, Lebanon, the statue of Ishtar, and the Nazca lines in Peru. These are just a few of the things that I put together that in my research convinced me anyway. Now, my book, frankly, Mike, is just a research reporter. I'm a reporter telling what I see.
Right.
And it's up to the people who, you know, study and read the book to make up their own mind any way they want, whether the story has, the genetic engineering has any validity to it.
Right. Now, I think in my mind I can see the tablet that you're talking of that showed the solar system from that time ago. So presumably the Anunnaki passed this information on to the Sumerians, and it must have spread to other tribes
or countries. My theory, Mike, is that every advanced civilization does a couple of things when they conquer. For instance, when the Spanish conquistadors conquered the Indians in Central South America, they first of all conquer them, they destroy their culture, and then they impose their thing. Their thing happened to be Christianity. The Romans, when they conquered, their thing was Roman law. They imposed it on everybody. We, in effect, as a superpower, go around the world defeating enemies, and we impose democracy on them.
Right.
Kind of a historical thing. So the Anunnaki, to me, were not only transmitting information to the Sumerians, they were transmitting information to the future generations of mankind, so that we would one day, when we reached our space age, have a touchstone of information that they were able to transfer to us through the cylinder seals and through the writings in the cuneiform tablets.
Right. Now, I get the impression, and I think it's probably accurate from, again, the writings of Setchurai Sitchin, that the Anunnaki deliberately presented themselves as gods so that they could control the Sumerians, and I believe at times they were quite, shall we say, evil in the way they used the people and set them against one another.
Right. I think you're right, Mike. But I think in the beginning, if you read Gilgamesh, the first story that ever appeared on the planet, and I do a whole chapter on that in my book, Gilgamesh is a period of time in the beginning when they were interfacing, the Anunnaki interface with the people of Uruk and so forth. And at that time, they weren't gods. They were just superior beings who were helping the Sumerians with all the firsts that they created in their civilization. You know, that's kind of an amazing thing when you look at the first civilization on the planet that was recorded. The Sumerians had all the firsts where they get them. It doesn't happen naturally. They were given them, and they admit it. They admit that the Anunnaki gave them all of their knowledge.
Right. Now, do I recall correctly that you actually sell a CD or video from your website about the Epic of Gilgamesh? Am I correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Right, okay. So
I had on the website there's an e-book, there's a hard copy book, and then there's the CD which has the story of Gilgamesh plus the e-book in it.
Right. Now, how do you connect all this with what I think was the original question that started you off? Because you wanted to know, I believe, how a 5,000-year-old Bible description of the birth of our solar system disclosed the advanced scientific knowledge thousands of years before we discovered it. Now, is that correct?
That is correct, yes, sir. I was a Bible student when I was at Caltech in my undergraduate years, and I was very curious about, like, for instance, Genesis 6:4 says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of man, had children by them, and they were the heroes of old, men of renown. Well, hey, who were the Nephilim, and who were the sons of God? You know, this is a question that I presented to my professor. I had a couple of really outstanding professors. My chemistry professor was Linus Pauling, and I asked him if he believed in God. And he gave me a very straightforward and honest answer, which helped me greatly in my search for the answers to these questions.
Right. So you can actually take that part of the Bible as being accurate then, because you can confirm that by what you found out about the Anunnaki. So that, they bear one another out.
Say again?
Do they, you're the Bible entry and what you found out about the Anunnaki, they actually bear one another out as far as the birth of the solar system.
Yeah, okay, well here's the thing. You know, I was studying how solar systems are born at Caltech. 100 years ago we kind of figured out how a solar system comes into being. And what they taught us, and by the way my physics professor was Richard Feynman, one of the most brilliant minds of my generation, that in order to be successful, a solar system needs to form the planets, and then late in the process, the sun needs to ignite. In other words, to go thermonuclear. And once the star is born, then you have a solar system. Well, I looked at the Bible's 7 days of creation, and it says on the fourth day out of a six-day period, God created the greater light of the day and the lesser light of the night. And I said to myself, well, that's late in the formation process. How'd they know that? Where did that information come from? We just learned it 100 years ago.
Right.
So that was one of the things that, you know, sparked my interest and continues to generate my interest. And I believe that in our schools, we're now teaching evolution. I think intelligent design needs to be part of that curricula. And I also think that genetic engineering needs to be taught so that the students can choose, make up their own mind what they want to believe. But we need to give them the information. It's been around for 130 years.
Well, of course, the trouble is, because this information didn't fit in with the orthodox beliefs, it's been largely ignored or hidden away, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The scientific community doesn't want to have any part because they didn't discover it. You know, it's like we didn't invent it, so it doesn't exist.
Right. Talk a little bit more about how you found physical objects on the Earth that support your claim. For example, did you find any link with the Great Pyramid, for example?
Yes, I did. They, in their writings, they have described, and I reproduce a lot of the translations from Zachariah Sitchin in my book, and when it comes to the pyramids, they say why they did it, how they did it, and when they did it, and they never did anything very simply, Mike. What they did is they always built things in like mathematical formulas and you know alignments that were precise to the equator of the Earth. And in the pyramids, I discovered the one most fascinating thing was that from the air, you can only see this from the air, there's a slight indentation on each of the four sides. Notice they're not straight. Pyramids
yes.
we always thought were straight, but these are indented purposely on all four sides. And Isaac Newton discovered that this indentation was exactly the radius of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's stored information, information that we need to know. Because how else would we get that information?
it certainly proves that the Great Pyramid wasn't down to a handful of, thousands of people building it in two.
No, and the other thing is that they're casing stones which weighed 10,000 pounds and were put in at right angles to the structure stones to seal it. It's like a tile roof. And they were the white polished limestone which reflected the beams to the horizon, and what they were using them for was an infrastructure beacon, so they could line up the pyramids between Mount Ararat and the landing platform, which is at Baalbek. This is all in the book. People can research that. But what I discovered was that the stones were glued. They were precisely manufactured and glued together up there. And the thing that fascinated me was that we've analyzed the glue. We can't reproduce it. And the stones are still on the mid-pyramid hanging up there. They don't fall down because they're glued up there.
Right.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And there's hundreds of things in the pyramids and Stonehenge. And then the stones at Baalbek, Lebanon, where the landing platform was, three of the largest quarried stones ever produced on the planet Earth. They weigh 1,200 tons each. And they were lifted from the quarry and transported up the hill and placed end-to-end perfectly without any mortar. We can't do that today.
No.
And the Romans didn't do it.
We've never done it.
Well, I wish I'd go there one day, but unfortunately I think it's in control of Hezbollah right now.
Now, what do you think the purpose was for the Anunnaki to get involved in this way? One suspects it was probably for their own gain, because did they not mine the gold that they found on the earth?
Yeah, let me explain to your audience what I've read. Now, this is just what's in the text. You can believe it or not, but they have a planet that has an orbit around, it was captured, it's a free-floating planet that was captured by Neptune's gravitational, pulled in clockwise into our solar system, and does a 3,600-year orbit around the sun and goes way out to the Oort belt, comes back. What keeps them alive on their planet is that they have this very thick atmosphere and an internal heat source. But they had a hole in their ozone. Apparently they did some things like we do, maybe, and they were destroying their atmosphere and they were going to lose their planet. And the story is that the only thing that would save them was gold. If they had gold, they could seal flakes of it and close the ozone hole and save their planet. Well, they didn't have much gold on their planet. The story is they did a survey of the solar system, found Earth had all the gold. So 450,000 years ago, they came to this planet to mine gold, to save their own planet. That was their sole purpose. And apparently for 200,000 years, they were sending gold back to Nibiru, their home planet, and it worked. It saved their atmosphere. But in the meantime, the story is they had a mutiny in the gold mines. It's down, you know, in Southeast Africa, and it goes way down. It's very hot and very hard to do, get the gold out. So they needed somebody to replace their own workers. And they couldn't use Homo erectus because they couldn't talk to them. They were uncommunicative. So one of their scientific engineers, a guy named Enki, said, I can put mark on Homo erectus and we could produce a primitive worker. And in fact, Adam, which they created, fit the bill. They succeeded after many mistakes in producing, through genetic engineering, a bicarmal creature, which they called Adamu, and it was the primitive worker. And I translate one of the things on page 40 of my book. For instance, this is direct from the Sitchin's translation.
Yeah.
Enki, the boy child held in his hand, the image of perfection he was. He slapped the newborn on his hind parts, and the newborn uttered proper sound. He handed the newborn to Nima, and she held him up in her hands. My hands have made it, victoriously she shouted. Now here's the important part. Shaggy like the wild ones he was not. Homo erectus was a hairy creature. Dark black was his head hair. Smooth was his skin, smooth as the Anunnaki skin. Like dark red blood was its color, like the clay of the Abzu was its hue. So Adam actually was a sand person. He wasn't Caucasian. He was African. And then it goes on to say that the human genome study reported in 2001, humans contain 25,000 genes. Science magazine reports that the human genome contains 223 genes that do not have the required predecessors on the genomic evolutionary tree. The question is, from where did these alien genes come? So we all got them, as we're all genetically part of the Anunnaki strain.
Right, yeah. Now, one thing I did find interesting is the reference to, I believe it's the Anunnaki, putting on an eagle's helmet, and more importantly, a fish's suit, because in a lot of the tablets, they do depict the Anunnaki, I think it's the kings and queens, or whatever they call them, with the body of a fish from about the waist downwards.
Yes, some of the depictions on the cylinder seals show many different shapes and sizes, and the fish thing was that when they first landed in the Persian Gulf, they tried to extract the gold from the water, and it was not a very efficient process, and they had fish suits that they went into the water with to make that process work. In future, the helmets, I think the most important find that I point to in the book is the statue of Ishtar. There is, found in Mari, Syria, a full life-size statue of this princess Ishtar. She has two horns on her helmet, but the helmet is definitely kind of a space helmet. It has a box in the back and a pipe and shoulder supports, and it's kind of called Shugaru in the translation from Sumerian. Shugaru means goes far into the universe.
Right.
Kind of fascinating. These bits of information add up.
Yeah, and it's funny you should mention the two horns on the helmets, because again, I can remember looking at the tablets, and they seem to often depict their people, like the Anunnaki, with headgear that had two horns on it.
Yeah, well, it was rank. They all had number ranks.
Yeah.
The highest rank, like Anu, the king, I think had five horns on his helmet, and his two sons, Enki and Enlil, were four. And it was like, they had a grand council. This is interesting to me from a political point of view. There were six men and six women in the grand council of the Anunnaki, so that the women had some input, apparently, into major decisions that were made. And by the way, when Enki proposed to Enlil to create Adam, he said, no, we can't do that. And they went back to Nibiru to their grand mucky-mucks to say, you know, whether you could create a new creature, because apparently it's against the prime directive or something.
Yeah.
And they said, no, you can't do it. And so Enki said, well, do you want the gold or don't you want the gold?
Yeah.
He had the trump card. And they said, okay, go ahead. We need the gold.
Right.
So these are little sidebar things that you pick up as you read the translations. And they were human in many respects. They were probably a civilization that represented, I'm guessing, a million years more advanced than humans because of the things they were able to do.
Yes, apparently they were certainly advanced in making or using weapons of terror, because some of the stories sound, if you like, very much like experiences that we have had in modern times.
Oh, yeah, the atomic war that they created. They called it the Great Calamity. I love the way they treated it.
Hmm.
It's like, they got the feuding amongst the clans, and they had seven atomic weapons that came on the original rocket ship that came to Earth, celestial chariot, shall we say.
Yeah.
And they buried away and hid them, and somebody revealed where they were. And then in the Bible, we have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which if you read it in the context of Hiroshima, you can see it was an atomic blast.
Yes. Yes, interesting. You mean when Lot turned to
a
column of salt?
Exactly.
Yes. Right. So,
and the people's flesh was coming off, and they were, you know, it was just horrible. And what they didn't count on, Mike, this is interesting. People wonder what happened to the Sumerian civilization. Well, this seven things going off, seven atomic bombs, it drifted to the east and the north, and it spilt atomic fallout over Sumeria and destroyed their prize. Their civilization was the prize of their creation of cities, and they destroyed it totally.
Right.
They called it the evil wind. I have another story that I think your audience might be interested in. When I was at Caltech, Linus Pauling, who was a brilliant chemist, recognized that we were testing all of our weapons in the atmosphere, and that the fallout from the test in the atmosphere was going to destroy our DNA code and our whole civilization. So he went around the world by himself, talking to the major atomic powers, telling them to please bury their tests underground. And he received the Nobel Prize for saving us from the evil wind, which
yes.
is kind of a repeat of what happened.
Mm.
He's the only Nobel laureate that got two Nobel Prizes by himself, too. One for the saving us and the other for some chemistry thing.
Just getting back to these special workers that the Anunnaki created,
mm-hmm.
did they survive? I mean, are they our ancestors, in other words?
Now, here's an interesting thing. I've asked that question myself, Mike, because there are different, there's like Homo sapien and there's Homo sapiens sapiens. And the original clones, Adam and Eve, were, neutered. I mean, they couldn't reproduce. They could, the clones can't, like, mules can't mate with mules and produce mules. So they had to do an upgrade to the species, which was taking something out of Adam's rib, putting it in Eve, and making it possible for them to procreate. But that species is still the original primitive worker species, and later on, the gods, or not gods, the lords like Enki, had intercourse with females and produced superior humans. Adapa is the example of a direct offspring from Enki and a female human, and this became Homo sapiens sapien because he was much brighter and he could teach him things that Adam couldn't learn. And that was because the infusion of their DNA was direct into the genetic strain that we are. So I think we are probably have evolved over the thousands and thousands of years with various types of these strains. It might be that the original Adam, which was an African clone, produced offspring, and those offspring were not as brilliant as the later ones that were Homo sapiens sapiens. I don't know. I'm speculating on that, Mike.
But so from what you've said, and I think some people who don't follow the orthodox idea of natural evolution would accept that there is a missing gap, and that is simply because we have been altered genetically. In other words, there's been a jump rather than a natural evolution. Yeah.
I'd call it a jump start. Yeah, right.
Yes, right. Now, I gather the Anunnaki also had, obviously, technologies that were very advanced. And what was it they used lots of water for, to cut a path through boulders?
Well, you know, there's speculation that you can do from what they've written and what they did. For instance, how did they level the foundation for the pyramids in Giza? That mountaintop was made out of solid granite, And it's acres and acres and acres of foundation that is leveled to plus or minus a half an inch, which is incredible. It had to be some kind of a power weapon, maybe a laser beam that chopped the mountaintop off. And I, people who say that, you know, well, no, the Egyptians did that. I said, well, Egyptian tools were copper and bronze, and I doubt that they were able to hack through granite and make that mountaintop foundation, because the weight of the stones of the pyramids was humongous. And they had done previous pyramids in the sand, and they didn't work out too well. They kind of settled and cracked and so forth. So when they decided to do the Giza pyramid, they took this granite mountaintop and leveled it. In my book, I show some pictures that I found of Cairo in the 1700s. Yeah. And in the background, there are little tiny mountaintops that are lopped off level, kind of like overspray.
Well, of course, Egypt, with the Great Pyramid Complex, is a very fascinating place anyway. What was this point that you raised about the moon having been destroyed by Nibiru? Which moon were you talking about?
Say again?
You mentioned in your book, I believe, about the moon, or a moon, having been destroyed by Nibiru.
Oh, yeah.
And I wondered
What the story, according to Sitchin's translation, which he did a brilliant job of deciphering the cosmology of a poem. The poem was written, they wrote everything in poetic in time, but it's just, to me, a highly intelligent way to tell stories. But they said that when Nibiru came through the first time, it's a huge planet. It's bigger than Mars and smaller than Jupiter. But as it passed around Earth, which at the time wasn't Earth, it was called Tiamat, it was a watery planet, it's one of its moons, one of Nibiru's moons, called Northwind, smacked Tiamat and knocked a huge hunk out of it, which I associate with the hole in the Pacific Ocean, and caused the asteroid belt to be created, and also in a clockwise direction the comets. So it was the moon of Nibiru that did the first destruction, and it took so much mass away from Tiamat that it was the fourth planet. It slid into the position of the third planet. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, I was wondering, for a start, which moon it was. Now, you said it was one of Nibiru's.
Well, yeah, Nibiru's moon, and Tiamat had its own moon called Kingu. And Kingu, when it slid back into the third position, became our moon. And I just learned the other day that without our moon stabilizing the orbit and the spin of our planet, we'd be in real trouble. It seems like our moon is able to control the axis of rotation of Earth because of its huge nature and its gravitational pull on our planet, and keeps us in the 26-degree angle, which causes the four seasons. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. I've heard a phrase, Mike, which I don't, maybe you've heard it also. We're the Goldilocks planet. We're just right in every way to make life possible, and that there aren't going to be too many other planets out there in these other galaxies that we're going to discover that have the right position, the right water, the right everything to support life.
Now, as the Anunnaki were so advanced, what happened to them? Because presumably at some stage they disappeared.
Yes. That's a good question, Mike, and I really don't know the answer to it, because there was a conversation, which I've reproduced at the end of my book, between the two brothers, and in it they said, if we return to Nibiru, we're going to die. Apparently they'd been on planet Earth for so long, they were immortals. They apparently had genetically engineered their own bodies so they never died. But there was a story, was what's going to happen if we go back. So they either went back or they didn't go back. But I have not found any evidence in my research that they're still here. And there's a lot of questions out there right now about the return, whether they're going to come back. I would personally hope that they don't, because I agree with you that they were very dominant and warlike. You know, the two things that we inherited from them, since we got their DNA, I'll throw this out to your audience. The Anunnaki were fierce warriors, and they were oversexed.
Yeah.
They absolutely, their life stories lead like, you know, something out of a trashy novel. So what did we get? We got warlike tendencies, and we got oversexed. I think that's our inheritance from them.
Right. Now, there is a story that I've read that apparently Nibiru has come back into the solar system and is stationed somewhere behind the sun, and it moves round the sun so that we never actually see it. The inference being that they are waiting for something to bring them back maybe to the Earth. Have you ever heard that story at all?
Yes, I have. And one of the things that I was always interested in is the cycle, you know, the 3,600-year cycle, and when would they appear. And in my research, and I reproduce it in the book, there have been major civilizations that have observed it and recorded it. The Sumerians recorded it. The Hebrews recorded it. The Hittites, and, you know, every 3,600 years you had to be there to see it. Now, the Greeks called it Nemesis. They saw it, and they called it Nemesis because its gravitational interruptions when it comes through are tremendous. It caused volcanic eruptions. It causes all kinds of tidal things that are, you know, the flood. The flood was the result, according to the Anunnaki, of one of the passes of Nibiru that pulled the ice shelf off the Antarctic and caused this 1,000-foot tsunami that covered the Earth. And that the Ark wasn't an Ark. Ark was actually a submersible in order to survive a tsunami. But I wondered why the Romans never recorded it. Because they were around for, you know, 700 years, but it might have happened during their period of time. And my curiosity, Mike, is what was the Star of Bethlehem?
Yes.
Has anybody really zeroed in on what that phenomenon was?
Maybe a spaceship. I said maybe a spaceship.
Yeah.
Could have been Nibiru.
Yeah, it could have been. Right. Could have been. Yeah. I mean, there are a coin. There's a coin with a star on it at that period of time, but because of the story of Jesus and the wise men and all that goes along with the Star of Bethlehem, nobody was paying much attention other than that this was some kind of a guiding light. Well, it could have been. Now, in my calculations, if it was, like, zero, Nibiru was going to appear again 3,600 years from then.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the, you know, we're 2,000 now, so we got about 1,600 years to go before it shows up again. That's just my, you know, way of trying to figure out when. And I've gone back to the flood. I know the flood story said if the flood was 11,500 years ago, you could keep subtracting 3,600 and come up with another answer.
Right.
Because it is cyclical.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I was about to ask you about the Great Flood because, again, I remember reading some of Secheri's work that apparently the Anunnaki became angry with the people when they rebelled against them. And one of the brothers, I don't know which one, Enlil or Enki, decided to destroy them, and the flood was what they used.
Enlil said we were too noisy and we were diluting their bloodline.
Yeah.
That was his rationale. But they knew. Right. See, they knew that when Nibiru came through, that the Earth had warmed up and that the Antarctic ice shelf was loose and it was going to cause this tsunami, which would wipe everything out and kill everybody. Now, the interesting story that I reproduce in the book is in the story of Gilgamesh. The 11th tablet of the story of Gilgamesh tells their story of the flood.
Yes.
And I often wondered if that was purposely told just so that we'd have the information that really what really happened. And it's a fascinating story. Noah was Enki's son. And he went against the rulings of his brother, who was the commander. Enlil was the commander. And he got a message. This is interesting. From their deity. Now, their deity was called the Creator of All. And they listened very carefully when the deity pronounced things. And what the deity told Enki in a dream was that you must save mankind because the destiny, get this, the destiny of the Anunnaki was to come to Earth to create mankind, and the destiny of mankind was to inherit the planet Earth and take care of it. So he went ahead and did it, and against his brother's pronunciations. And the confrontation at the end is kind of interesting, because when he finally confronts his brother and tells him about the dream, and the word came from the creator of all, Enlil does a 180-degree turn. He says, well, if, you know, the creator of all said that, we got to do that. And let's help him, because, you know, after the flood, there was no way to get food. Right. Everything was covered with mud. So the Anunnaki actually saved humanity by producing the staples of life that they needed, because they couldn't do it themselves.
Right, yes. Now, do I recall that the king of the Anunnaki was actually called Anu?
That's right, correct.
Yeah. So, did he come to us?
Oh, yeah, once.
Oh, he did, yeah.
Yeah, there's a recorded story of the great ascension from Nibiru, and it's all ceremonial, and, you know, trappings of power, and there are some stories of how he became king, which was kind of interesting.
Now, presumably, Marshall, you have been to Sumeria.
No, sir.
Oh, you haven't? Right.
Oh, no. I wish I could. But it's kind of the part of the world that I don't think I can get to right now.
Right. Well, the reason I've asked you is I just wondered whether the Temple of Jupiter, which I read about in the tablets, which is in Sumeria, was apparently flat on the top, especially for the Anunnaki spaceships to land on. And I wondered if it was still there.
Say again?
The Temple of Jupiter in Sumeria.
Oh, the Temple of Jupiter, yeah. Yes.
Was apparently built to allow the Anunnaki spacecraft to land on.
Yes. Is it called a Ziggurat?
Right. I was hoping you'd been there and you could actually say whether or not it still existed.
Well, here's what I think of as a, you know, I'm an engineering graduate and I studied physics and chemistry and all that stuff. And I know that in order to get off this planet, you got to push against something. If you go down to Cape Canaveral and you look at the launch pad, there's millions of tons of concrete underneath the rockets, which it pushes against, so that it can get airborne. In the Baalbek landing platform, these three stones that I talked about provide a push point. Also, you could land on them. I don't know what their landing devices were, and I don't know what their propulsion system was, but I know from the law of physics, you've got to be able to push against something to get airborne. And maybe they have, in their advanced technology, figured out how to get around that.
Yes.
With anti-gravity devices or whatever, I don't know. There's no evidence. But I do know this, that they used Mars as a way station. And Mars had water, and they were using water for some sort of propulsion system, kind of like a sprinkler hose or whatever. And when the Nibiru came through at the time of the Great Flood, it wiped the atmosphere off of Mars and took the water with it. So they could no longer use that as a base from which to launch the Nibiru. It was kind of a way station.
Yes. So do you think they possibly had a base on Mars?
Oh, they did. They claimed they had a base, and they put some guy in command there. And one of the rebel kings was buried there. It was quite active. No,
well, it's interesting because there is also some evidence to suggest that these rather tiny space people with rather large heads compared to the size of their body that have visited Earth are actually from Mars and perhaps are the original Martians. Now, what do you think about that?
I think it's very possible, Mike. I mean, you know, I don't know everything, and I've tried to research as much as I can. And the reason I produced the book is I think this story is so complex, yet it has so much merit that I wanted to be, my book is kind of like Life magazine. In other words, it's large, it's an 8.5 by 11, and it has all these 145 pictures in it, and people can easily go through it. Now, Sitchin is a very, very scholarly writer, and I'm sure when you've read some of his books that you've found the same problem. You really have to work at it to get the information out. So my book is a offering to the public to gather this information, assimilate it, and make up their own minds, but not have to really work very hard at it.
Right. So now, if your book, which you say it does, proves that we are the descendants of extraterrestrial visitors, where does the Orthodox God or the Creator fit into these stories?
Okay. Who created the Anunnaki? They have a deity called the Creator of All, so that there is a line that we can trace back to their planet anyway. And we don't know where they, we think they maybe came through an explosion from Sirius or someplace. They always show these the belt of Orion as one of the signs that they leave in the sand, and they say that's where they came from.
Yeah.
So I think this has been going on for an awful long time, and that the deity that they have is the same deity that we have, and that, you know, people really need to understand that you can't just dismiss God from this equation. And that's why I want the three books to be taught in our schools, the evolution, intelligent design, and genetic engineering. And from those three, you can combine and have a very nice feeling about religion and creation.
Mm. Of course, your immediate opposition would be the church.
Of course. Except, now I'll tell you, let me tell you something. The church has put out a fellow named Monsignor Balducci. I don't know if you've heard of him or not. But he's the Vatican's chief science officer. Balducci's going around the world saying, we really don't care where the bodies came from. Our responsibility is for the souls of mankind. So the church is into the soul business. And if our bodies were created by aliens, so what? They're preparing them. They don't want to get caught like they did with Galileo and the Earth being the center of the universe.
Yes. Well, I certainly seem to remember, I think it's Balducci who said, announcing that the church does believe in the existence of extraterrestrials.
Yes, that's basically what they're saying. I mean, I'm delighted with their position because they represent a large population in the world, and I think that faith-based beliefs are important for many, many reasons, and that I'm not out there with my genetic engineering theory trying to dismiss the deity. I have a question for you, Mike.
Right.
I researched your webpage and Salusa.
Yes.
Tell me about Salusa.
Well, Salusa is a Syrian, a member of one of the crews on board one of the mother ships. He's part of the Galactic Federation fleet, which are currently stationed in and around the Earth, waiting for the opportunity to officially land on the Earth. And this is all in connection with the ascension, which is coming within 2-3 years, because of a great alignment with our sun and the great central sun, which is going to raise the level of vibration and therefore people's consciousness levels. That is how I would describe it.
Okay. That's good.
Yes. So they do say when they come, which of course would please you, that they will give us the truth about our history. They say that a lot of it is, well, incorrect or actually false and deliberately so contrived to hide the truth. So a lot of these things that you're talking about no doubt will be qualified and given the thumbs up or the thumbs down.
Well, you know, there's one thing I believe in, and I'm sure you've encountered this also, is that the victors always write the books, and
yes,
they portray the history the way they want to.
Absolutely, yes. But that's what they said about history, yes. That's absolutely correct, and that even applies to modern times, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You read these stelas about these, pharaohs and what they did.
Yeah, write your own truth.
Right now,
we've been getting along so fine here, Marshall, that time's shooting on a bit, and I want to give you an opportunity to give people your website address and give any other information about things on it that people can look at or read or whatever.
Okay, well, the web page is www.adamthemissinglink.com, the title of my book, adamthemissinglink.com. And on that web page, you will find a store which you can use a credit card to acquire either the e-book version of it, the hard copy version, or the CD, which is a video of the story of Gilgamesh plus the book. And it's simple. I'm not, really trying to influence people. I'm trying to give them information. And I feel that my book is not slanted. It's just what I found as a investigative researcher, and I've reported what I found. And people should, enjoy the book and then make up their own mind.
Yeah. I mean, what you're basically saying is your book is a history book, and you've made it as factual as you can.
Exactly.
And you're not sort of trying to go in any particular direction with it. You're just presenting the truth as you found it.
Well, I wanted to convince myself, because I've been wrestling with this problem all of my life, Mike. And
yes,
when I found Sitchin and I found this theory and I found all these facts that go back 250,000 years, I said, now maybe I can get a handle on what I need to feel about it. And while I was doing the book, it dawned on me that this would be, helpful for other people who maybe are puzzled or conflicted with their own beliefs about what they were taught as children. But my main goal now is we're working on a film script, a movie, which will be the first of a trilogy, in order to get the stories out in a larger audience. The History Channel here in the United States just completed the 5-part series, Ancient Aliens, and that hit a lot of audience, but I think the biggest audience is the movies. And we're looking for a producer to help us bring this to the public in a very fun way, which will also be educational.
You're talking about the screenplay that you and your wife have written, is that right?
Yes.
Yes, that's based on your book. Yeah, that's fine. That sounds very interesting indeed, I must admit. Well, look, it's been fine to have you on the program, Marshall. I can't believe how quickly the time's gone.
The time just flew by, Mike, and thank you so much for inviting me. And if you ever want to do another one, I'll be happy to carry on and give you the new stuff that I find.
That's great. Yes, thank you. You've been very welcome, and it's been extremely interesting. So that all that remains is for me to thank you on behalf of the listeners and announce next week's guest, who is going to be Aurora Juliana Ariel, who's the president and founder of the Institute of Advanced Healing. And what she wants to talk about is her latest book called The Quest, Heal Your Life, Change Your Destiny. And I think it was released last Christmas, and with it, she also leads into 2012, what she thinks about it, and she says we are in amazing historic times. So, again, we can look forward to that program. Thank you for being with me. I hope you enjoyed it, and you can be with me next week. Thank you very much. God bless you all.